You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. It's day 9 with the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location at Slam Dance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of this year's most important and exciting voices in independent film. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. On today's show, we will have a critics roundtable with Ann Thompson from IndieWire, Dino Ray Ramos from Deadline, and Caitlin Booth from Bleeding Cool. Then we'll have a documentary, Behind the Bullet. That's a Slam Dance film. We've got Heidi Heumann, she's the director, along with Will Little, who's one of the subjects of the film. And then a Sundance documentary, Shooting the Mafia, and that is Kim Longinato, she's the director, along with Niall Fagan, the producer, and Ollie Huddleston, the editor. And then yet another documentary. It's a documentary fest today with Philippe Lesh, he's the co-director, along with Rachel Lee Jones. And we have the subject of Advocate, Lia Sim. You are listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. We have a Hot Topics roundtable we're going to do right now. Three great writers with us. Ann Thompson, who's the editor-at-large at IndieWire. Dino Ray Ramos, who's the associate editor of Deadline. And Caitlin Booth, who's the editor-in-chief of Bleeding Cool. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, let's. I want to start off right now talking about movies. All three of you. Tell me what the favorite film you've seen thus far. So I'll give you guys an out for films you haven't seen yet. The favorite film you've seen thus far. Dino, start with you.
Oh, right now it was Miss Purple.
Oh. Yes.
Not just because Justin's kind of a friend of mine, but I think he's a talented filmmaker. And I think once he kind of gets his groove, I always am looking forward to what he's doing next. I think that's the thing. And I have a special place in my heart for brother-sister movies. And I don't think there are enough brother-sister movies because I have an older sister. And especially since it's told through an Asian American lens. And I really connected with it. And that's what I have liked so far. I have to admit I haven't seen The Farewell yet, but I know I'm gonna like it.
Oh yeah,
Farewell yet either.
Yeah, oh my god. yeah. So I'm loving Miss Purple right now, and so that's mine.
Okay,
thus far. Yeah,
Caitlin, you're up.
So I've kind of got two.
Okay.
I really, really liked Apollo 11.
Okay.
I'm a huge space nerd. And so that movie was just like 90 minutes of joy. I'm just sitting there. And the thing is that it's a documentary in the truest form. There's no narrator. It's just Mission Control. And Mission Control narrates everything that's going on as it is. The only criticism I would have is that some of the transmissions can be hard to understand sometimes. So it will be a benefit to have subtitles along with it. But just from a technological standpoint, it's incredible. The fact that they managed to put this together. And I also saw Leaving Neverland.
Oh. Yes, please talk about that.
Now we're getting into it.
Let's jump right in.
I don't want to say it's a favorite, but it's definitely necessary and was brutal and yeah.
Okay, yes. We've all been kind of anticipating what that would be. Anne?
Well, I loved Leaving Neverland, and it is really hard to watch, but a must-see, and I highly recommend it. It will be on HBO, and it's 4 hours, and it's worth every minute of it, and it stayed with me and disturbed me for a long time.
Oh, it's still with me.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And then I loved The Farewell.
Oh, my God, I'm so jealous.
No, it's
I schlepped totally out to the Redstone to see this because I heard such good things about it. This is a really gifted young filmmaker telling a personal story.
It's incredible.
With Awkwafina in a way you've never seen her before. She's a good actress.
Yes.
And she's funny, but she's also heartbreaking. And it's a family story that's really universal. Mm-hmm. But it also showed me something about what that kind of disconnect between an American who comes from another culture, going back to that culture, really experiences, which I hadn't quite seen before.
Yes, yeah. I, after seeing the movie,
I immediately called my wife and said, you need to get this for your festival. You know, it's like, yeah, it is on all levels.
And it's been picked up.
I know, A24.
Which is the hot distributor.
No surprise festival. Yeah. That's not a surprise,
A24 though. Is doing amazing things, and I just like how many risks they take with their films and how bold they are and how, you know, they champion these like visionary filmmakers, even if it's so bonkers or if something heartfelt like The Farewell, which like I know I haven't seen yet, but I got to talk to Lulu and I've been telling this story over and over again. And I think I told we were texting about how connected I am with that story because I recently lost my grandmother and I just came back from the Philippines last Saturday from burying her.
Oh my God, you're gonna be a mess.
Yeah, and
don't
Dino,
watch
I think
it. Maybe
I know I need to watch. And as soon as I read the premise, I was just like, "Oh my God!" And it was just right before I interviewed her and Awkwafina. I practically was crying during the interview, and then Lulu was all, "I'll cry with you," and that even made me even more, you know. And then there was like this big group hug at the end, and so I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to being a mess. Thank you.
Yeah. And I'm a space nerd too, so Apollo 11 was amazing.
Yes,
and some of the backstory behind that, in terms of how they achieved all of that, even the sound stuff, in terms of syncing it and making it digital, is if you really are a nerd or about how they make movies, that's for you.
I have to throw out also on the space nerd thing, Memory, the making of Alien.
I'm going to see that later.
Oh my God. Festival. That one is
awesome. I guess
awesome.
I'm space nerd adjacent. I'm not. I mean, I'm not. I'm sure you guys are like really space nerd, but I like it. Mm-hmm. I like space.
It's out there. I feel where Apollo 11 is concerned, if you remember it,
okay,
which I'm old enough to do, it might have a different impact on you. Okay. I wonder about that.
Okay, the next topic, and this one is a little tougher, and you and I have talked about this in the past on past shows, and that's a discovery. And I mean like a true discovery that for each of you that's come out of nowhere, not someone that's been, you know, kind of primed by a publicist or a Sundance Lab or something like that, but something that you were completely unexpected, either performer or director, thus far.
Oh, sure.
All right, Dino.
God.
You're on the spot.
No pressure, Dino.
I want to say I saw this film called Adam, director Reese Ernst. It's an LGBTQ movie. I was just like, okay, that's fine. You know, I mean, I love an LGBTQ narrative. But then I watched it and I was like, oh my God, this is his vision and this story. It's based on a book, but the story is just so fun. It's basically a story about mistaken identity and like even a sibling relationship. Again, brother, sister, wrapped in an LGBTQ like love. And it's about this kid, this awkward teenager who goes visits his lesbian or queer sister in New York for the summer. Mm. He falls for this girl. The girl thinks he's a trans man.
Oh, yeah. That's a twist.
And so that whole movie, he's trying to kind of, you know, be this trans man among this queer community. And it's interesting in how Reese handled it and how he, like, didn't make it so, exploitative. And he's a trans man too, Reese. And he, through that gaze, he's kind of like just, and then he cast a bunch of trans, bunch of queer talent. And it was a pleasant surprise. And I'm like championing this film. And I think he's going to be doing amazing things. So awesome. I really recommend seeing Adam because it was just so fun and funny and awkward. And I love an awkward movie, you know? Yeah. And just, and then you see the story of, you know, trans identity like unfold in front of this kid who's like kind of naive. And he kind of represents a lot of people in this world. So I think that's what also drew me to it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Caitlin.
I saw Paradise Hills yesterday.
Another Awkwafina.
The movie's going to be one of those, you're either going to really like it or you're really not going to like it. You're either going to get on its wavelength or you won't. But everybody's going to walk out of that movie going, that costume department is fantastic. I was not expecting that costume department to create the things that they created. And the cinematography also is just fantastic. So I didn't know quite what I was getting into. I knew it was going to be different because it's the next movie, so of course it's going to be very different. But I wasn't expecting it to be as intricate as it was and as detailed as it was. And it was very, very obvious that everybody who worked on that movie just put so much love and care into everything. Every frame of it is just very beautiful. And, you know, like I said, whether or not you can get on its level is going to be, you know, as on a person-by-person basis. But if you can, it's beautiful, absolutely a beautiful movie.
Hmm. Okay, and I'm always anxious to hear what you're saying.
I'm going to go with the movie Native Son. Oh. Rashid Johnson is a discovery as a new director. A little bit, he reminds me a little bit of Spike Lee in the sense that he has that eye. You know, you can just, every frame is gorgeous and cinematic. And I, of course, discovered Ashton Sanders in Moonlight. He was the middle adolescent kid, a tall, skinny guy with the extraordinary way of expressing his emotions without really showing anything. He's like that in this, only he takes it to another level. He's playing Native Son. He's playing bigger. And it's an extraordinary performance. And then the Barry Jenkins, Kiki Layne is in this too.
Oh my God,
from
I love
Beale
her.
Street could talk. So it's just a very rich mix. But performance-wise, Ashton blew me away.
Fantastic. Mm. Okay, now here's the last one. Mm. And maybe we don't have a lot of time, but someone that we're familiar with, someone that, you know, has had a career that, you know, that we've been very, very familiar with, that totally surprised you, actor or director, that you saw a film and you said, you know something? Wow, okay. And I'll buy you guys some quick time. Riley Keough, for me, The Lodge, and I think she's in another film here. I was talking with someone that I think, man, she's just working with the coolest people. And I was like looking at what she's doing, and especially in that performance in that film, is going, I cannot wait now to see the next thing that she does based on that. Okay, thank you.
No, I have one now. Like, I was nervous.
Me too.
I want to say Matt Turnauer, Where's My Roy Cohn?
Oh, okay. Oh.
Good movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I know, because when he first released Valentino, I was like, oh, and he worked for Vanity Fair, and he's like such a phenomenal journalist. So I'm always like, and he did a Studio 54 thing, but then when he did Where's My Roy Cohn, and just the way he unpacked that. I mean, I was very vaguely familiar with Roy Cohn, but then you're just like, oh, he was Beta Trump, you know? And you just watch this story and you get so frustrated. He made me mad, that documentary, but in a good way. Like, it lights a fire underneath you and you're like, oh, let's not make this mistake again. You know, let's keep our eye out for these demagogues and these like horrible people. But yeah, I think Matt Turnauer, I think he's like, I was familiar with his work, but with Where's My Roy Cohn, I think he took his directing to another, like his like documentary filmmaking to another level.
And Sony Pictures Classics picked
that. Oh, yes. Yeah. I just read that,
nice.
Yeah.
Okay, Caitlin.
Yeah.
Pretty much the entire ensemble cast of Paradise Hills. Seriously, like Mila Jovovich, Emma Roberts, Awkwafina, Isaac Gonzalez, like everybody in that movie is doing something that you're not going to expect. And I especially liked Mila Jovovich in that movie. Like, I don't want to get into any details about what she does because it's kind of a bonkers performance, but she really, really goes for it, and I really appreciate a person who's willing to chew the heck out of the scenery.
Awesome. Okay, Anne, you get the final word.
All right, I'm going to go with an incredible two-hander, if you like, The Report.
Oh.
Scott C. Burns' new movie. It's the first time he's done a narrative feature film. He's done some TV stuff. He's a great screenwriter. He's worked with Soderbergh. But the performances he gets from Adam Driver, who we know is a great actor, and Annette Bening, who we also know is great, is extraordinary. As this guy, Dan Jones, who's a whistleblower, kind of, and a researcher, who could be boring as hell. And he gets more and more and more angry. And it's amping up the whole time. And finally, he's exploding. And he's almost crazy.
Oh,
but
wow.
Adam Driver perfectly modulates it. Meanwhile, opposite him is Dianne Feinstein, the California senator. And this movie makes these two people into heroes. But she is also nailing it. And the tone is just perfect between them. They could get nominations for
this.
Did
it just get picked up as well?
I don't think it's gotten picked up yet.
The report just got picked up.
Was it A24?
By A24.
Yeah.
Amazon. I wrote it down for a reason.
It begins with an A.
Amazon has had a big festival because they picked up the $19 million late night.
Well, I have to say, this has been the most fun Hot Topics I think that we've done yet. We've had with us IndieWire's Ann Thompson, Deadline's Dino Ray Ramos, and from Bleeding Cool, Caitlin Booth. Thank you three for being here.
Thank you.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with the Bitch Talk hostesses Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora, my teammates on this show. And right now we're going to talk about Behind the Bullet. It's a slam dance film. We have our director, Heidi Heumann, and we have one of the subjects from the film, Will Little. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Heidi, let's start off with this. I always, you know, want the directors to introduce our listeners to the film. This one, I would love for you, as you introduce it, because we're talking about different case studies, can you talk about, can you briefly let our viewers know about the people that we're talking about in the movie?
Yeah, sure. So it's four people who are featured in this film, all who have pulled the trigger. And it's really about the impact it's had on their lives. So we have Will, who's here with me. He shot somebody on the streets of Philadelphia and went to prison for 10 years. We have a guy in Washington State who killed an intruder that was in his home, ironically stealing his guns. We have a woman who was shot in the face and has been having surgical recovery ever since for the last 5 years. And then we have an 8-year-old boy who found his mom's gun and accidentally killed his little brother, who was 5, and we film him 10 years after the fact, so he's 18, telling the story and what's been happening the last 10 years.
And whenever I watch a documentary that has a handful of case studies like this, I'm instantly curious as to why these particular case studies made them in the film, whether or not these were the people that you just happened upon originally, or there were a larger group and you said these were the most interesting or worked for the film that you wanted to make. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so my original idea, we sort of shifted things. The original idea was to show Kevin, the one who killed the intruder. I wanted to do those kinds of stories and figured out very quickly that that didn't create very much diversity. And so diversity became really important to me. And so we have a woman, we have a man who's African American, we have an urban environment, we have suburban environment, we have different ages. And so I wanted to tell the story in different ways. And part of it, and I'm finding the audience is really responding to it, everybody can see their own family or recognize their own environment in this film because we have it's such a diverse group of folks, and that was really important.
And I know my partners on the show, Angela and Aaron, all three of us have been talking about this movie. I know the two of you wanted to dig into this thing.
Go ahead. Yeah, I would love to talk to you, Will. Obviously, your story kind of saved me while I was watching this film because it's heavy. Right. But I love the story of redemption and giving back to your community and showing that you're more than the worst thing that you've ever done.
Right.
So if you can explain your journey with it and what you're doing today.
Well, mainly because as I grew up in an environment which was really violent and drug related and poor, being the only son my mother had other 5 children, I always trying to find a way to make things easy on myself and easy for her as a kid. And being the only man in the house, we had a difficult time growing up. I had a difficult time adjusting to life in general. And I was influenced by my environment, thinking that I would find a way out. And that influence took me to the streets, selling drugs and dropping out of school and eventually carrying guns and using them. Once I was arrested, my son was born. I had a son myself. He was born 9 months later, and then it kind of triggered a light in my head. Like, do I want this for my son? Do I want this for my child? You know, I wanted to be a father to him because that's something I was lacking myself. And I knew that in this world, you would need some guidance and direction. So I started, you know, self-discovery. You know, how did I become this person? Because I know we all don't start off the way we end up. And just reflecting on life in general as the natural, the innate abilities that we have to survive in life. I mean, the creativity, the imagination, the love, the non-judgment, and things of that nature. I began to go back to my human self, you know, and transform my life. And then after I started learning more about life in general and myself, I started connecting to other people and how much this information is really needed, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had to be the sacrificial lamb to really say that I'm not going to be another statistic. I mean, to go in and out of jail, back and forth to prison. I'm going to come out and do something for myself and for other people, you know, especially for my son. So when I started learning more, I started mentoring in prison, and mm-hmm. that was a thought for me to come out in the street and get back to the same environment that I took so much from, you know, by just doing crime and taking lives.
Mm-hmm.
And just now is about pro-life, you know, just sharing our feelings and understanding the pain and understanding the misinformation that we received as young men and women, thinking that that's all we had, that's all was offered to us, you know. But come and find out the world is offered to you.
And Will, you know, we live in a reality TV world where we are all going to have a camera on us at some point, we think. But even with that, not all of us are the subjects of a documentary.
Right.
Not all of us have a camera with someone like Heidi behind that camera, following everything you're doing and basically assessing what you have been doing,
right,
and what have you. And I was very interested to talk to you because you have made a point of recalibrating your life and speaking out on it,
right,
and you know, and talking to you know, to groups of men, you know, that haven't come to that point yet in their journey, and this is something that now it's on film,
mm-hmm. right,
and you know, and I'm assuming you've seen the film, mm-hmm. and so what is that? How has that colored, you know, your viewpoint of where you've gotten to now?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it helps me in the mission to share the message of transformation and evolution, and being in the the activism lifestyle, you know, you want to be able to spread your message far and clear, especially if it's connecting with people, especially if it's opening minds, if it's changing lives. And being in this film will actually help that initiative. Yeah. You know, will help me spread the message out far and wide, farther than I can reach, you know. And I just appreciate Heidi, you know, and Sky, you know, for bringing me a part of this project, you know, because it's a very important project and it's a very important topic that needs to be shared and talked about, that we're not having this conversation. So maybe we can start having this conversation in 2019 and beyond.
Mm. And Heidi, I want to talk to you also about, you know, the scrutiny that the camera brings, mm-hmm. and that, you know, and that being a subject of a documentary brings. And I want to talk about the young man who shot his brother, and
Taylor, yeah,
yes, and you know, and the dynamic between he and his father, mm-hmm. they're evangelical, and, mm-hmm. and the father, there are moments that I have to tell you, you know, I was not a fan of the father, and because it mm-hmm. seemed like you know he was capitalizing on, you know, on this in a way. I thought, you know, you could view it in that sense, with the proselytizing, you know, and utilizing the message, and you know, and you have, you know, the son who is behind him because they're musicians, mm-hmm. you know, playing in front of them, and so his son is listening to this, and obviously is listening to this all the time, over and over and over again, and so it doesn't seem, you know, from what we're watching, that, you know, that this is, you know, a healing thing for him, mm-hmm. or that's even really frankly considered by the father. And I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Yes, yeah, so it was quite a privilege actually to hang out with Taylor and Darren, his dad. And I spent 2 weekends in North Carolina talking to them, building the trust, and was really appreciative that they let me mm-hmm. come into their home, and it's a really difficult situation. And what was interesting is when I was filming, I have a son that is the same age as Taylor. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching it from a mother's standpoint as I was filming. He looks just like Taylor. My son is also a drummer. So I commend, it's an impossible situation when your son kills your other son. How do you help that person to not just be crushed by guilt? And I think Darren, I think he's done a really good job trying to protect him. I don't know if it's been effective. They certainly lean on their faith a lot to be able to, and that's what he's done. There are no playbooks out there. There's no book out there to tell Will, this is how you should deal with what you've done. There's no playbook to tell Taylor, this is how you deal with the shame and the guilt and the loss. And my impression was that Taylor really hasn't had an opportunity to really fully experience what he's done and what's happened. Mm-hmm. He's in an environment where the evangelical Christian, there's a family script that they've mm-hmm. put together to help him. Mm-hmm. Taylor's not on drugs. He's not doing really bad things. This is where they're at right now, and it'd be interesting to see what happens in 5-10 years.
Yeah.
Especially when he's not in the family system.
Because mm-hmm. there's some startling moments where you see you see the wheels turning in Taylor, and those wheels are saying, I don't know if I'm completely buying this, because right. mm-hmm. I don't know if I completely understand it. Those are really affecting moments.
So I guess to your point, I think Darren is doing his best in an impossible situation. And I see your point, absolutely. I don't know if I would do any better. It's an impossible situation. And, you know, they had a gun in their home. It was not handled in the right way at that one moment, and their lives are forever changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's a tough topic. Obviously, an always relevant topic right now, especially mm-hmm. in this country, yeah. And a really good addressing of that topic. Again, we've been talking about the film Behind the Bullet. It's a screening at Slam Dance, and we've been talking to the director, Heidi Heumann, and one of the subjects, Will Little. Thank you both for being here.
Yeah, thank
Thanks
you.
For having me.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with the Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW. This episode is supported in part by Black Rain, Studio Movie Grill, and Slopestyle Realty. For more episodes and information about the Bitch Talk podcast, please find us at bitchtalkpodcast.com.
My name is John Wildman, here with my co-host from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Andrew Tabora. And on this segment, we're going to be talking about the documentary Shooting the Mafia, which is screening at Sundance. We have with us the director, Kim Longinato. Did I say that right? Longinato?
You said it perfectly, yeah.
All right. Neve Fagan, the producer. Did I say that right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and then Ollie Huddleston, I think I'm okay on that one, our editor.
Yep, that's right.
Fantastic. And Kim, we'd love to start these segments by giving our director the opportunity to introduce our listeners to the film. So describe the movie, Shooting the Mafia.
Okay. Well, the film's about Letizia Battaglia, who's a photographer, and it's the film's through her life, really, but also through a very tumultuous, brutal time of her country. So it's about the mafia through her eyes.
It's a remarkable film in that it tracks this period of time that we've mythologized through movies like The Godfather and other films and what have you in this country, and it really unflinchingly looks through her photos. But she's just an amazing, charismatic personality as well. And so you're introducing us to her. Talk about how you found Letizia and how you discovered her and wanted to talk about her.
I'm really happy you said that about the mythology of the mafia, because that was one of the things that kept striking Ollie and I, because we looked through all the old mafia films. We made ourselves look at all the sort of fiction, the American fiction. Mm-hmm. And when you look at that, it's very much these kind of rather cool-looking guys, you know, mm-hmm. and killing each other. Mm-hmm. And it's very sanitized, and they get shot, but that's it. You know, you don't feel the pain of the people, the families, and you don't realize that most of the people getting shot are often shopkeepers. There's a photo of Leticia that's a guy in a garage, and he's been gunned down, and he's got the rag where he's been cleaning the car in his hand. Mm. And actually, they killed children, you know, from the very beginning. And occasionally people say, oh, that's a very, you know, recent thing. But Ligio, who's one of the mafia people that we follow, he murdered a child because the child had witnessed him shooting a man in the hills. And they did this horrible murder of this child. And the whole village knew that they'd murdered this 11-year-old boy, but nobody dared speak about it. So it is a kind of trauma that's locked a country. And I think what the film's about, really, the real honest answer what the film's about, it's really about people that dare to stand up against, you know, against brute force. So it could be people in this country standing up against indigenous people having their land taken away. It's all those small things that people can do to stand up against a big fear. And hopefully that's what people will take from it, from whatever country they're seeing it. They'll say, okay, it is worth standing up. You know, I'm going to take the risk and stand up.
Well, it's interesting also because Leticia talks about her photos, and oftentimes she will say, like, I hate this photo, or I hate the people who love this photo, and I wish I hadn't taken this, you know, after the fact. And while so, and it's oftentimes a reaction that because people view it as art, and so they're looking at it from that lens, but she remembers the moment.
Exactly. I really loved, I really identified with her saying, you know, it's hard when you're taking a photo to tell people that you're taking it with love. Because often, Ollie and I have edited 9 films together, this is our 10th. Yeah. You know, there'll be stuff that I've filmed that actually, in a way, you sort of feel you shouldn't film it, but you know you have to. So you're split. Your heart's telling you, Kim, don't film this woman grieving because her son's just died. You know, this is wrong, you're her friend. And then your head's saying, look, you have to film it, that's what you're here for. And it's so good to have somebody honestly telling you about that, about her work, how she felt really bad. She felt compromised morally by taking these photos, but she knew she had to be a witness to it.
And yeah. Ollie, we don't often have an editor on the show, so it's great to get the editor's perspective, especially a film like this, because you know, you could have made one documentary just solely on her personality. You could have made one documentary just solely on the photos themselves. You know, or you could have made a documentary on the on the prosecutors. You know, the three major. And so there's a lot the two of you are weaving into this. And Eve, I'm not going to leave you out because I know you know, you're the producer, so you're over their shoulder too, saying, "Come on, two of you." but let's talk about how you're shaping that story. And this one in particular, what the challenges were for you as the editor?
I think, I mean, in all documentaries, from the outset, I tried to, we always try when we work together to make the film as much an experience as possible. And with archive films, that's particularly difficult because so much of what you can find is in small snippets, little bits. So what we ended up doing, so one of the prosecutors that for example, called Falcone, one of the main guys that chases the mafia in the film and takes hundreds of them to court. There's an amazing, he unfortunately gets killed, and there's an amazing funeral scene. And that funeral scene is probably made up of, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, maybe 20 films. So in order to create the sense of actually being at that funeral and get a sense of what mafia murders and the murder of this particular people's hero on the people was, what it felt like to be there, we had to trawl through hours and hours and hours of stuff. So you're trying to find emotional connections to that sequence of events. So there was one shot where two men are weeping in each other's arms, and that's just from one film. We knew we needed that in order for it to come alive.
I'm glad you mentioned that about Ollie, because for this film particularly, I'm really, really keen. I'm really excited that Ollie's here, because it absolutely is an editing film. I mean, it was made in the editing room. Normally, with documentaries, you come back with the film. You've got beginning. Well, the beginning's always tough, but you have an idea, and it's chronological, so you can't do a lot with it. But this film could have been 1,000 different films. And actually, I think it's fair to say it was an incredibly painful, difficult film to make. I mean, half the battle was getting the archive, so you had these two people looking for the archive. But also, actually, to balance everything, so you're not saying, oh, hang on, we've lost Leticia, we're back with the mafia. You know, too many characters. you know, to balance it and make it understandable.
Of a piece, of a whole. And the characters, the mafia characters, the male characters are extraordinary. But actually, when you got into Letizia, when we really truly got into everything that Letizia represented and all the things that she'd done in her life, it was so clear that she's an extraordinary woman that stood up against the male dominance, against the male kind of controlling, brutal, totally uncaring world. And that is the story that we've kind of majored on, really.
Mm-hmm. Ollie's an honorary girl. He totally is. Well, he's the sweetest, gentlest person.
Well, the other thing that's hilarious about Letizia is that she is such a strong force. Yeah. She's talking about, like, and he was my lover, and then we moved on.
Yes,
and then she was another guy.
I would like to get to the lovers.
Let's talk about the lovers.
I really feel like. Like, did you know that she had this train, or was she like, oh, I have another lover that you can talk to about this part of my life? Oh, but what about this other lover?
Actually,
and they're all best friends.
It's funny because actually Ollie had it really good at one point. We changed it. Where one lover goes, and then you had this rather jaunty music, and the other lover arrives.
much younger than the last one.
So
at the end, when Kim fills the scene where she's got a very young partner now, a much younger partner, and I was like, wow.
Yes, she does.
Yet. You know, girls, there's hopefless yet. Yeah. When we get to 80.
I am not mad at all.
For 40-year-olds.
She is my hero. Yeah. She's not afraid of the mafia. And they're all best friends, her exes. They just all still have this love and connection. She's
really
just so
good.
Powerful. Yeah.
You must tell her that if you see her.
Can I please meet her? I would like to be best friends with her.
She's
so
we'll talk after.
And Niamh, I want to get you into the conversation here. You know, you're the producer of this documentary. You're premiering at Sundance. Can you talk about your hopes as a producer as far as the reception for the film, here as opposed to anywhere else?
Well, this is my first time being at Sundance, so I'm absolutely ecstatic and honored. I think it's an amazing achievement. And I'm delighted that it's with such a strong and brilliant film. I'm very proud of the film. I adore Letizia. I met Letizia in 2015 after seeing her work in 2013. So it's been a long road for me to bring her and to bring her story to this point. So I think it's quite an achievement, really. I think Kim and Ollie have made a beautiful film. And what's really interesting is Letizia hasn't seen the film yet.
I was just about to ask you.
That's the big one.
Big reveal. And in equal measures, you know. Yeah. But she's very excited. She's here now. And
that's why we're saying, tell her you like the fact she's got all those lovers.
Yeah.
Do tell her that.
I would be honored, yes.
Yeah, great.
You know, she is a remarkable woman. And I do think, as Ollie and Kim were both saying, that just for somebody, you know, doesn't take too much for you to make a stand. You know, for her, it was her camera. For her, it was living her life the way she felt she should live. And I think every one of us as individuals, you do one small thing, it can have a big impact.
And, you know, we do have to wrap up pretty soon here, but I would love to have the three of you weigh in on the responsibility to your subject. When it's someone like Letizia, who's this wonderful personality and has, you know, lived this amazing life, and so you as the people, you know, documenting her life through this film, you have a responsibility to her, and what does that mean to you as filmmakers?
Go on, Niamh, you haven't said much.
Well, I think we all had tremendous respect for Letizia, you know. I think. She's a very honest woman, so it's very hard not to be just honest with her story. And I think Kim has really, and Ollie have really carved out that beautiful honesty, and she has a humility, and I think it all comes across on screen. I think what you see is what you get, and when you meet her, you'll feel the same way.
I think to make a film as transgressive as she is.
I agree, I was going to say. I don't think it was that difficult in the sense of, I wasn't worried, I'm not even particularly worried about what she's going to say tonight. She's I've not met her either.
She's going to love it.
But I've seen a lot of her on film, hours and hours. So I get, she's just out there. She's one of those people that just says it as it is.
Yeah.
So I think she'd be very happy for it. And there's a lot of contradictions in the story. She, as you mentioned earlier, John, you know, the pictures she never took, the pictures that she did take, she's incredibly conflicted and in pain with a lot of it. And she's known for taking photographs. The thing that she's known for is the stuff that she finds most painful to even think about. So
Well, it is a thoroughly engrossing film. Congratulations to all three of you.
Thank you.
We've had Kim Longinetto, the director, Nee Fagan, the producer, and Ollie Huddleston, the editor of Shooting the Mafia. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. We're going to be talking about the film Advocate documentary. We have the two directors of the film, Philippe Balaiche and Rachel Leah Jones, and we have the subject of the film, Leah Sen. Wonderful to have you all three here.
Hello.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
All right, now let's start off with Rachel. Why don't you introduce our listeners to the film? Tell us about Advocate.
Advocate is a documentary about Leah Tzemel, who's here with us. Leah is one of Israel's pioneering human rights lawyers. She's been working in the field for 5 decades, covering the 70s, 80s, 90s, many, many, many years, dealing with people who resist the occupation, be they Israeli Jews or Palestinians. Given that more Palestinians resist the occupation, most of her clients are Palestinian. Mm-hmm. And we follow her in her real-time sort of, you know, current caseload. And we also go back and revisit some of her milestone cases, or milestone, I guess that's what it's called, and look at her trajectory politically, personally, professionally.
You know, Leah, oftentimes on this show, we have the good fortune to have as guests subjects of documentaries that, after we see the film, whether we've been aware of that person or the scope of their work, it's really a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I would love for you to talk immediately about what it was like having these cameras and these two following you around, and as you went about your daily business, which is daily business that is
not so daily business.
Yeah.
Not your everyday business.
Yes.
Well, it was not difficult, as a matter of fact. First of all, you should know that my work usually is very controversial, so usually there are journalists around in big important cases, as you can also see in the movie itself. And besides, they made me feel very, very convenient. And as part of the event, more or less. So it was not difficult.
Okay. All right. Philippe, talk about the approach that Rachel and you took to Leah and her story and her daily process.
Look, I can give you anecdotes. For instance, in the movie, we have in a scene Leah shouting at her a colleague who is late, telling him, "What? You will never be here at 8. You have to know that Leah is getting up every morning before 6. She's at the office at 7. So we were trying to do the same, getting very early, going with her, being there. And just in this part of the movie, which is kind of a cinema vérité, won't say fly on the wall because we were moving, but in the office, but we were just observing what's happening. The only way was, you know, to call Leah and say, "Hey, what's going on tomorrow?" She was saying, "Nothing special." I said, "Okay, so we're coming."
Yeah, nothing special to you. Yeah. What does that mean? Well, we spent some time in Israel. I was there for 3 months in 2014 during the Gaza War.
Oh.
And the feel that I got from my friends that lived there is just, it's just always this constant unrest and turmoil, all times of year. So watching this documentary really brought me back to that. And so we watch your life and the turmoil and the battle that you have every day. But that's also kind of just what comes with living in Israel.
Well, I was born there, and I'm there. And I don't have any second thoughts about it. But the general major thought is, of course, how to make it a livable place for me and for the next generations. Mm-hmm. So yes, that's how it is. Day in, day out, always emergencies, always calls, always someone has been detained, whether a Palestinian or an Israeli demonstrator, and it doesn't stop. Mm-hmm. It's true. It does not stop. But the it's true that I was one of the first Israeli lawyers to do this job. But now I'm happy to say that there are some more. And it doesn't make us more successful, I mm-hmm. must say. Mm-hmm. Because also, as you know, the political situation is deteriorating mm-hmm. tremendously and quickly. And everyone in the government stops speaking even about peace or about a peaceful solution. Mm-hmm. So we are, I'm afraid, even going to face bigger turmoils.
Yeah, can you tell us how you maintain this optimism in the face of that? Because you say it, we don't win these cases. A win means maybe 1 year less off of a sentence. Okay. But how do you maintain that optimism? Can you teach us? Because we don't go through such intense things, and it's hard.
It's stupid to wake up every morning and say today is a new day, another day. I don't know. I don't know if it's a new lesson, a good lesson, but. I would answer, since the just is with the cause, it is a just cause. And we are me and my friends and the people around me and those who are searching for coexistence and peace and equality back there, we are following the right cause. And therefore, we must win sooner or later. Mm-hmm. That's this belief, at least.
Mm-hmm. You know, watching the film, you know, I was struck throughout by the sure hand that you have on behalf of your clients, and of course, as we do sometimes when we watch films like this, we place ourselves like what if that was me and I needed that support and that representation, and it's remarkable to watch it. And to know that this is this over and over and over and over again, that you're doing this, you know, on behalf of people that need it so desperately, and I would love for you to talk about that sense of responsibility that you have.
It's enormous responsibility for every lawyer in every case, and especially in criminal cases, and more than that in political cases like ours. When we are not part of the establishment, you know, all of my clients are out of the establishment, more or less. But I try, first of all, to consider all the legal aspects, all the proofs, of course, the situation. Sometimes I say, okay, let's go for a plea bargain because that's the right thing to do. And very often I say, no, let's fight for it. It's a good cause. It's a good fight. Even if we lose, we still mm-hmm. made some progress. Mm-hmm. And I offer it to my clients. And once they agree, we go together at it. You know, everything is so human after all. Mm-hmm. Even those enormous terrorists, after all, the basic is very, very human. And I'm trying to pass that truth also to the judges. It's not easy. To the press sometimes. Mm. And I'm happy that we don't have jurors, but if we would, try to convince them about the basic truth behind every case.
Mm-hmm. Rachel and Philippe, I want to bring it back to you on the filmmaking level. And you know, a question you know we frequently ask on this show is what we call the Eureka moment. That moment either during filming or in the editing bay where you go, oh, this is the movie, and this is the moment, you know, that we know we have the movie we were hoping for or that we weren't even expecting to have. Mm-hmm. I would love for both of you to talk about that from each of your perspectives.
I think it was a film where we completely knew what the last scene was when we were filming it, and it's when both cases that we follow get sentenced. So it's a natural end, but the end is not because they get sentenced. It's not because that's the end of the legal process. There is, of course, an appeal. We filmed the appeal. We knew it. We sort of knew it wasn't in the movie. When Leah faces all the press at the end, and she says, there is an occupation, and people have the right to resist that occupation, mm-hmm. and they do it with whatever means that they have. Mm-hmm. And when you see her, all 5 foot nothing that she is, facing so many journalists, foreign, Palestinian, and Israeli, and speaking her truth to that power which she doesn't ultimately have the power to knock down, even though, as her daughter says in the movie, my mother still believes she's going to do it, and she's going to do it single-handedly. She's mm-hmm. going to get, she's going to defeat the occupation, and mm-hmm. that is the stuff you wake up in the morning with to go yet again, mm-hmm. Into the arena for another round. Mm-hmm. But that was clearly where the film ended. It ended on, well, that's not true, because then she, she gets in the taxi. It ends is, she's the Energizer Bunny.
Yes,
you're not going anywhere. Yeah.
Now, what I can tell you, if I would say Eureka, was, I think it was on the very first day that we filmed, the way I saw that Leah was reacting to the camera, which is almost not reacting. Most of the people that you're filming, it takes between 30 minutes to a week before mm-hmm. they get used mm-hmm. to you right. and forget you, in a way. And Leah, it was quite immediate. Because what she's doing is so intense and she's so much into what she's doing, you're here, you're not here. She's with her clients. She's not performing for you. And it's so when I felt that, I knew that there were going to be a movie.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, again, the title of the film is Advocate. We've been talking to the two directors on the film, Philippe Baliche, Rachel Leah Jones, and of course the subject of the film, Leah Semin. Wonderful having you all here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're wrapping up the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. The show is made possible with the support of KCPW and Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors include Black Rain, hemp-infused products that focus on wellness, relief, and recovery, Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Caroline Cromwell of Slope Style Realty of KW Park City, Keller Williams Real Estate. Additional support is provided by Nasty Women Wines, Pro Bar, Uinta Brewing, Couple Co. Podcast, and Whole Foods Market in Park City. The show is audio produced by Charlene Goto with production help from Angela Rowling and Sophie Gunther. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan.
Tune in tomorrow, which will include interviews with Frankie Quinones and the crew from the episodic The Dress-Up Gang and Stephanie Lang and Dave Hill from the episodic Bootstrapped. See you then.